House Committee on Intergovernmental Affairs, May 4th, 1989.
Call the House Committee on Intergovernmental Affairs to order, and why don't you run down the order that we're going to take these.
Mr. Chair, of the bills on the agenda for today, we will be taking up Senate Bill 360 first. Then we'll be taking up the package of bills dealing with the Metropolitan Service District. It's our intent to take up SJR 2, the Home Rule Charter Bill, first, followed by two bills that relate, that also relate to structure and function at Metro. These would include Senate Bill 212, dealing with their passport license program, and Senate Bill 258, which deals with the governing structure of the agency. Following those bills, the final two bills on the agenda deal with financing at Metro, dealing with their dues assessment and a proposal for an excise tax, and we'd be taking those bills up last.
Okay, we'll open the public hearing on Senate Bill 360 and call on Gary Conklin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Gary Conkling, Public Affairs Director for Tektronix. I'm appearing today in support of Senate Bill 360 and to urge its passage. By way of background, the legislature in 1987 approved Senate Bill 9, which contained a provision that prevents cities from annexing large improved industrial tracts with more than $7 million in assessed valuation without their owner's consent. This provision was enacted with a two-year sunset clause, which expires this September. Senate Bill 360, in its amended form as passed by the Senate, extends this provision for 10 years through 1999. This provision grew out of a mounting concern that large industrial property owners had little ability to defend themselves against unwanted annexations initiated by cities. In a number of cases, cities had moved or threatened to move to annex industrial properties, even though the industry involved had not requested any additional services from the city initiating the annexation effort. In some instances, if the industrial property had been annexed, it would have been subject to receiving urban services of a potentially lesser quality than if it had remained outside a city's boundary. And in too many cases, the industrial property owner would have wound up paying more for that service than they were currently paying. Clearly, cities have seen large improved industrial tracts as highly desirable annexation targets. The term cherry-picking is commonly used to describe the effort to annex these kinds of properties. The $7 million assessed valuation figure contained in this provision is admittedly a political compromise. However, we prefer retaining the figure because it appears to be high enough to include the kinds of industrial property that most often attract cherry picking, while low enough to ward off the claim that this provision benefits only a few very large interests. In supporting the original provision in 1987 and Senate Bill 360 this year, Tektronix does not mean to suggest that there is anything wrong with cities or that annexation is undesirable. Indeed, virtually all of our industrial sites and our industrial properties are within city limits. The two exceptions happen to be in Washington County. Howard Vollum Park, our headquarters and main campus, and Tektronix Walker Road, the location of one of our manufacturing groups. These are large, sophisticated manufacturing sites. Howard Vollum Park includes a wastewater treatment facility. Both sites have roads, lighting, sewerage, security, and other facilities paid for by Tektronix. These sites currently receive excellent, affordable water, fire, and sewerage services from large, sophisticated special districts. These sites are also located within the Beaverton School District, the Tualatin Hills Park and Recreation District, which, by the way, is one of the largest park and recreation districts in the country, I found out last night, and the newly formed Sheriff's Patrol Special District. They pay their way in the community. They are not impeding the prudent long-term planning and implementation of urban service delivery in our community. In fact, an argument can be made that they are aiding such long-term planning toward more economically sound, regionalized urban service delivery. It is worth noting as a historical footnote that when Tektronix originally located on its current main campus site, the company approached Beaverton about providing services. Beaverton was much smaller then and was mostly a bedroom community. Its officials, for whatever reason, chose not to provide those requested services. Tektronix consequently pursued securing services elsewhere, including providing much of the infrastructure for those services directly. Incidentally, the tech site was bounded then, as it is today, on the south and east by the city of Beaverton. Howard Vollum Park also shares a boundary with the city on the west on land owned by Tektronix that lies within the city limits. Tektronix bears no ill will to the city surrounding our two sites in Washington County. Indeed, our relationship, at least from our point of view, with the city of Beaverton has never been better. City officials and Tektronix have made great strides in working together as good neighbors. We continue to hold to our view that property owners of all kinds should have choices. If property owners choose to be in a city, we don't and have not objected, but we believe we deserve the same choice. Senate Bill 360 preserves that choice for us, and we urge its passage. Thank you.
Any questions?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Hostick.
Knowing you don't have any animosity, what is the city to the west? The unnamed city to the west.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hostica, Howard Vollum Park is adjacent to the city of Beaverton, and Tektronix Walker Road, after a decision tonight by the Portland Area Boundary Commission, apparently will be adjacent to the city of Hillsborough.
Okay, and the okay, so the way it sets it, that would set the limit at $7.5 million, and it has to be a facility that all the services are being provided beyond what the city is providing. Is that right?
Mr. Chairman, the current statute has an improvement test, and the improvements are laid out in the statute, as well as an assessed valuation test. Obviously, those two are related. The assessed valuation level of the industrial property, and it must also be zoned industrial, is $7 million.
$7 million. Okay. Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, let's hear from John Atkins and Phil Fell with the City of Beaverton and the League of Oregon Cities.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, I'm Philip Fell from the League of Oregon Cities. With me is John Atkins, who is assistant to the mayor of Beaverton, which of course is the Tektronix location, or on the edge of Beaverton is the Tektronix location. So John has some comments that he'd like to make, and when he's done, I'd like to summarize.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to appear before you this afternoon to testify on Senate Bill 360. I do want to, at the outset, associate myself with the remarks from Tektronix representative, Mr. Gary Conkling. We certainly do welcome the warmer relations that we've had with Tech over the last few years and hope that it continues. We basically have a philosophical difference here as to what's appropriate to annex and what isn't. The City Council of Beaverton voted unanimously to oppose this legislation, which would extend for another 10 years an exemption from Oregon's annexation laws for certain classes of private property owners. The City of Beaverton opposes Senate Bill 360 for the following reasons. First, we oppose it on grounds that there's no compelling public policy reason to exempt some owners of industrially zoned property from the annexation statutes that apply to everyone else. If you are the owner of industrially zoned property with an assessed value of less than $7 million and are adjacent to a city in the Portland metropolitan area, you are subject to annexation under the procedures set forth in ORS 199-490. If, on the other hand, the value of your industrially zoned property, which is adjacent to a city, is $7,001,000, then under Senate Bill 360, you're exempt from annexation. If you are the owner of commercially zoned property or any other kind of property next to a city, as long as it's not industrially zoned and regardless of its assessed value, then you are subject to annexation. Mr. Chairman, that's not fair, and it doesn't make any sense. What is so unique about property that happens to be zoned industrial and is worth more than $7 million that justifies such special treatment compared to property that's zoned commercial and is worth $14 million or property that's industrially zoned and is worth $6.9 million. We submit that the distinction is rationally impossible to draw and indefensible. These days, every developer of property, whether it's commercial property, industrial, or residential, is required to install water, sewer, storm drainage, streets, essentially all the infrastructure at their own expense as a condition of development. Beyond that, the exemption of industrially owned properties is a disincentive for cities in the metropolitan area to continue to offer and to market their city services to the unincorporated but urbanized areas outside their city limits. It's no secret that industrial properties, acre for acre, carry a substantially higher value than residential areas. At the same time, the demand for city services such as fire, police, road maintenance, and so forth is proportionally less per acre for industrially zoned property than it is for urban density residential property. The property taxes paid by industrial property owners, in effect, subsidize, we'll say that word, the more intensive level of services required by residential areas. The industrial properties, however, are the very same properties that have stimulated residential and commercial growth in the city of Beaverton. That increases the demand for city services. Beaverton last year had the largest amount of building activity in Oregon in terms of multifamily, single-family residential construction, the very kind of growth that demands, that creates the greatest demand for city services. It's not cherry-picking, Mr. Chairman. The city of Beaverton does not have a cherry-picking policy of attempting to pick off industrially zoned properties to the exclusion of other properties. If that were the case, Tech could have been annexed prior to the last session of the legislature, prior to the time this law was put on the books. But it is nevertheless a good policy for cities to try to maintain a mix of properties in their annexation activities, residential, commercial, and industrial, so as to maintain some kind of stability in the cost of providing urban services. If certain categories of industrially zoned property are kept off limits to annexation, then one of the incentives for cities to annex residential property is removed as well. Some may think that's a good idea, but the impact, Mr. Chairman, will be felt not only by cities with annexation programs, but by the unincorporated urban neighborhoods that want to come into cities. When the annexation equation breaks down, that is, when the costs of extending city services no longer equal the revenues obtained, then the opportunities for urban unincorporated neighborhoods to obtain from nearby cities the road maintenance, police patrol, streetlights, and other urban services they need and want breaks down as well. Finally, the industrial lands exemption provides an incentive for cities to try to annex industrially zoned lands while they are vacant or lose the opportunity for good. As a matter of economics, annexing vacant industrial lands is a poor alternative to annexing developed industrial lands. Vacant land generally adds little to a city's tax base. When vacant land within a city is developed and it's already inside the city's assessed value increases, but not its tax base. But when developed property comes into a city by virtue of annexation, the city's tax base is increased under state law by the product that results from multiplying the city's tax rate times the assessed value of the property plus 6%. Until now, it's made more sense for cities to annex developed industrial properties than to annex bare land, but not anymore. Now there is a disincentive to timing annexation so as to produce the highest rate of return. Senate Bill 360's message to cities is, annex whatever you can as soon as you can, or tomorrow will be too late. We don't believe that kind of local policy should be encouraged. Mr. Chairman, for those reasons, we urge the committee to reject this measure. If, however, the committee finds that there is justification for exempting certain industrial properties from annexation, then we would urge that the property valuation threshold be increased from $7 million to $50 million. This would exempt only the largest industrial manufacturing operations, which tend to be self-contained, campus-style operations, while leaving other industrial properties subject to annexation under the provisions of state law. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee.
Representative Cease.
You had indicated that your relationships with Tech are pretty good now. Give me a little bit more detailed, specific sense of what you mean by that.
We're talking with each other very frequently now. on transportation matters, for example, on city development matters. We are in a dispute with TEC over a east-west arterial that the city is planning to build, but it's a friendly dispute. We understand their position. They understand ours. I think we go back a few years when there was some conflict over TEC's request to come into the city of Beaverton. They needed sewer, they needed water, and Beaverton was a city of approximately 5,000 people at that time. And it seemed like too big a bite to take. So the city, for whatever reason, said no. And we've been living with that that ever since.
Mr. Chair, one other question. The $50 million PUU indicated would cover what? Would that cover TEC, or would they be in this side of it or the other side of it? What does that mean, $50 million?
I believe it would cover, it would certainly cover TEC's Howard Vollum campus, which is well in excess of a $100 million valuation. I believe TEC's Walker Road plant at 185th and Walker, and Mr. Conkling may have better figures on this, I think that's closer to $35 million. It may be over 50, but I think 35 is the number that sticks in my mind.
Mr. Chair, the fact that the current law has a sunset of 89, has that fact had any impact on your relationships over the past 2 years?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cease, I don't really think so. As a practical political matter, the city of Beaverton is not going to go riding roughshod over Tektronix. It's our largest private employer in the state. It means an enormous amount to the city of Beaverton. I think as a practical matter, TEC will come into the city of Beaverton if and when it is to TEC's advantage to do so, and not before.
Thank you.
Chair.
Representative Markham.
What was the genesis of the bill 2 years ago? Who hatched it up? Did the author testify just ahead of these folks? Anybody know?
Yeah, I think it was put in not just by TEC, but other large property holders that were on the edge of cities and had put a substantial investment in their infrastructure and didn't want to be taken in to the city without having any voice in it.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Stein.
Yeah, I was just wondering, has there been any impact in having this law on the books over the last 2 years? I mean, have there been properties that you would have wanted to annex that you were afraid to proceed on because you were afraid that they would reject your offer?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Stein, I can't say that that's the case. Most of the annexations that have taken place in the vicinity of Beaverton have all been residential land and some commercial land. We did do an industrial lands annexation, but the land happened to be vacant, and it was offered, the annexation took place as a consequence of a tax abatement offer that the city made and which was accepted by the property owners.
An additional question, Mr. Chairman. Mm-hmm. So do you foresee any problems on the horizon that would arise as a result of the law in the books right now?
If the $7 million, Representative Stein, if the $7 million threshold were to be maintained, for example, I think we would see a checkerboard pattern of properties, some of which would be in the city and some of which would be exempt from annexation in the area between Beaverton and Hillsboro. In some cases, the parcels that could be annexed and parcels that could not be annexed would be under the same ownership, and we don't think that makes a very good public policy.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, if I may, Representative Stein, the cities of Milwaukee, Eugene, and to some degree Portland have experienced difficulties with the $7 million assessed value figure.
I understand.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
Ask a question.
Yes, Representative Weehead.
Phil, do you have an estimate as to how many properties we're talking about around the state?
I don't have a specific estimate, Representative Weehage. In conversations with planners in the city of Eugene, they see 10 to 15 properties out on their fringe that are roughly in that valuation area. Milwaukee has indicated about half a dozen, and Portland has just a few out in the, actually out toward your area.
Representative Martin.
Thanks, Chairman. I didn't understand your statement a moment ago. If you said that some of the property would be inside and some outside with the same ownership is not good public policy, what's it to the city? I don't follow your logic.
I see.
Or did I misunderstand you?
No, you didn't misunderstand. When I said it wasn't good public policy, one of the things you want to see if you can arrange through mechanisms such as the Boundary Commission is logical city boundaries. And when you have a situation where state law prevents certain parcels from being annexed purely on the basis of valuation, and other parcels can come into the city, can result in this sawtooth or jagged checkerboard pattern of annexation where parcels may be surrounded in effect by a city, but not in effect actually a part of the city.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman,
yes.
I'd just like to indicate that the League echoes Mr. Atkins' comments that we have had concerns expressed from the two Boundary Commission areas, or the one Boundary Commission area, depending how the rest of the session progresses. And this has created difficulties for us. We continue to feel that we are responding to state mandates in our land use planning program and getting our plans acknowledged, and that this type of law does present the sawtooth or Swiss cheese sort of urban fringe development that allows possibly a single property owner to prevent annexation of other properties behind them.
Chair. Yes, Representative Cease. I guess so I understand this clearly, that you could have a situation where with this figure, whatever the figure is, but you could have a piece of property that could be annexed, say that's worth $6 million. Adjacent to it is a piece of property that's worth slightly over $7 million. You could annex one, and the other one you could not annex.
That's correct.
Have this. Indeed, you could have a checkerboard.
That's
in
correct.
In fact, because the law has drawn a line and hasn't given any rationale for the lie, but it simply said if you're on one side, you can be annexed, and if you're on the other side, you can't.
Did you have testimony, Phil, or are you just there for more?
I just wanted to make it clear that that's a statewide issue.
Why don't we have any testimony or anybody here from Corvallis or Eugene, or maybe we do have somebody from Portland that's going to testify with some specific.
Corvallis is not here because it is an issue in Boundary Commission areas.
Okay.
Mr. You mean that the bill relates only to Boundary Commission?
Correct.
It was drawn specifically 2 years ago for that purpose?
Correct.
Thank you.
What were the cities that had the problem then?
Milwaukee, Portland, and Eugene.
Oh, Milwaukee. Any other questions? I'll just make one comment while you're here. You don't like us to do anything with cherry stems or non-contiguous either. And it just seems to me that there's something here that says you want to have everything in terms of if it's out there and you want them in, you don't care whether they want to come in or not, you want the ability to take them whenever you want them. Is that too harsh, or is that pretty close?
Mr. Chairman, you can guess what my answer might be. And I would say that what we really want is some consistency between the requirements of the land use planning program and our ability to implement them.
I think a good amount of this committee still is not convinced when you talk about an orderly annexation policy that long cherry stems and non-contiguous meet that criteria, and who cares if the checkerboard is caused by the city doing non-contiguous or whether it's caused by some property owners that don't want to go in yet. It seems like it's the same situation, really.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'd say that growth on the urban fringe will, for a time period, be checkerboard as first one property, then another comes in. I think the question from our perspective is more how long will that checkerboard pattern remain, and what kind of logical urban service provision programs will it block?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Any other questions? Dick Horn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
My name is Dick Porn. For the record, I'm the president of the Cornell Oaks Association, which is a developer of a project called Cornell Oaks Corporate Center, located in Washington County. I'm also president of the Sunset Corridor Association, an association of approximately 200 developers and interested parties. Also, for the record, I was from 1974 to 1978 director of the Industrial Development Division for the State of Oregon Department of Economic Development. Cornell Oaks is located, as I said, in Washington County, approximately 2.5 to 3 miles from several of the questioned industrial properties. We are 140 acres. We've currently built 700,000 square feet of space. We have 42 tenants, about 1,500 jobs in our park. And we have plans to build between 1.2 and 1.5 million square feet, employing about 3,000 people over time. Within the Sunset Corridor Association, we represent about 2,000 acres of owners, 200 members, landowners, and associates, and I think we play a major part in Oregon's comeback story. We're very much in favor, that is, at Cornell Oaks Associates, in the continuation of the legislation which prevents forced annexations of business parks to cities. Competing annexation objectives and pressures of cities force us without regard to our needs to annex to a particular city. Our reasons for support are the following. If those of us who are involved in the development business feel that timing of development is important, we've worked with Washington County since 1961 with their rules, which are clear, their expectations, which are clear, with a development process, which is well-defined, and we are developing what we think is an outstanding environment with those objectives in mind. To change jurisdictions in midstream while we're still under development causes confusion and causes the standards to be different and the controlling conditions and regulations for both on-site and off-site improvements are different. And we are not sure that this creates an air of uncertainty for that developer. It certainly would for us. As you know, owners of industrial parks do not have the ability to vote on annexations because we do not create voting residents. So we need the protection. We're not looking for an exemption from annexation. We're looking for a choice. We've invested about $25 million in land, infrastructure, and buildings since 1981, and we'll expect to invest about $75 million over time. And certainly we feel that a home for our project is where it should be, based upon more than just the source of urban services. Large developers, which are provided for in this bill, are generally provide their own infrastructure for their tenants and for their users, and ultimately through the sophisticated districts which serve us. There are more than just issues in urban services, though. The form of government, the business climate of that government, the permitting process of that government, and the planning and public improvements and public direction of that city are choices that all of us would like to have. We at Cornell Oaks, and I think speaking for the Sunset Corridor owners, do not want to be islanded, do not want cherry stems, and then subsequently pressured into an annexation decision. Annexation should be a thoughtful process, and that thoughtful process ought to be based upon the long-term goals of the city and the affected property owner for a balanced and justified annexation. This bill allows that process to take place. Without it, we don't have that protection. Lastly, we are concerned about the annexation agendas. That is, various cities within our area may differ on their annexation policies. We do not want to be pressured into an annexation simply because it's the agenda of a city. The nearby businesses within our park have selected annexations to different cities upon their best interest and a timing that they and the city have selected. We don't want to be targeted as a annexation program of a city, but rather we would like to become a part of that city's planning process. And we would like to have that process be determined on long-term needs of both ourselves and the city. And finally, I think that the sentiments are shared by me and with me with the major industrial park owners within the Sunset Quarter. Some of these projects, namely such as Standard Insurance Company, have decided to annex to Hillsborough with no offsets, with no deals, just a straight annexation. Others have voted to join Hillsborough and Tigard and other cities within Washington County. It is their right to do so. We want to participate in the selection of our public partner when we go out into the marketplace to develop our property. And currently, we cannot select that public partner. If we have a partner that does not have the standards, that does not have long-term planning at a time that we think is important, then we would like to withhold that annexation. With that, I'd like to thank the committee for their attention.
Questions?
Sure.
Representative Martin.
Who is your immediate neighbor city that might be breathing on you?
Both Hillsborough and Beaverton.
Thank you.
Between a rock and a hard place.
And I'm
they've gone to say that if it's the intent of the legislature to supersede a charter provision, then the legislation controls. Now then you have a question of whether or not in fact there one, is there a true conflict, or is the legislation merely intended to adopt certain rules, and is the charter inconsistent if it writes a tougher rule, then maybe the charter isn't inconsistent with the state law. And there's a whole body of law as they've resolved conflicts in the area of police and fire pensions, building codes, other matters, taxation matters, as to how you resolve those conflicts. But the Oregon Supreme Court is found that where they found a clear legislative intent to preempt and an actual conflict, then the statutory provisions do control and not the home rule charter provision. The question of each case gets analyzed for deciding what the intent of the legislature was or whether there's a way around it to find that in fact there isn't a conflict, even though it might appear to some that there was, are issues they try to avoid having to overrule a county a charter provision, but if necessary, they've done so.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Seitz.
Would you have a sense, could the voters of the Metropolitan Service District now, by the initiative, give the service district a function that is reasonable and concern the implication? Or would it have to be related specifically what's permitted in the statute? I guess, what is their authority now under the current law in your sense?
There is a statutory provision that deals with certain powers that the district could exercise only with voter approval.
Okay.
There are some areas where the legislation as written now would not permit the voters to decide that something was a matter of metropolitan concern and try to give Metro the authority to do something that was, if it's inconsistent with the existing legislation. The legislation needs to be, if the power isn't expressly there or reasonably implied by that legislation, we just wouldn't have it, no matter what the voters said.
But this would permit them, if you had, if the legislation passed and you had a charter, you could provide in the charter that the voters by the initiative could simply give you a function that's reasonable and concerned, regardless of whether it was stated in the statute or not.
That might be true. I frankly haven't analyzed it from that point. We've been looking at this much more from the form of government and the question of taxation powers that might be granted through a charter that are presently not possible under the statutory provisions and for other ancillary provisions. It's not, I don't think, an ability to go on to entirely new functions. Now, I suppose that might be raised.
I've not thought of that question specifically representing CESPA, but as I look at Section 14, Sub 4, reserving to the initiative and referendum powers reserved to the people are applicable, and it specifically says relative to adoption, amendment, revision, or repeal of a district charter and district legislation. So I believe
voters
could initiate a charge for Metro through initiative.
If it was possible to put it into the charter to begin with, the voters certainly would have the ability to amend the charter through an initiative add or restrict.
If you're going to give the voters in the district any discretion in reference to function through a charter, obviously they would have to be able to in fact determine the discretion of what they wanted to do. Mm-hmm. If they had to relate it only to legislation, then the charter in reference to function would be meaningless, wouldn't it?
Well, I think we viewed this as, regardless of whether you add metropolitan concern or not, and it goes to Representative Hostica's question, what is of metropolitan concern is presently defined by the legislation that's on the books. A question of whether something else was of metropolitan concern beyond that, and I'm going to ask Greg to get me a copy of the statutes we've got so we can have some concrete examples for what you've said so far in terms of legislation. I don't believe that the voters could take something out of whole cloth that didn't fit within the statutory context and add it.
A copy of our statute.
Would it be fair to say if you didn't have the phrase metropolitan concern, then presumably they could take over a function from a city or a county, even if it didn't have any metropolitan significance? I mean, that metropolitan concern feature, which may not be nicely and specifically defined, does indicate, however, an intent that what the organization is to deal with is region-wide activities or those part of activities which have a region-wide concern. If you want to talk about parks or libraries, there might be features. As a matter of fact, there's a piece in the statute, as I recall, that says that the district could get into a region-wide library. They could get into some of the functions of libraries that are region-wide in significance, though they could not get into basic library, per se, under the statute. So that phrase, metropolitan concern, does become a significant part of what you can do, doesn't it?
Well, there's also a present statutory provision that limits our ability to take over existing facilities provided by local government except through intergovernmental agreements. And that limitation would survive any charter provision. And I think the courts would have no trouble but concluding that any attempt by a metropolitan service district to override that would be void, because you've got some specific legislation that would prohibit it. And the clear intent is that we not be allowed to do that, and absent action by the legislature to remove that disability, we simply wouldn't have that kind of power.
But even now, if the local government wanted to contract with you to an intergovernmental agreement, you could perform a service under contract, couldn't you?
Yes, we could. It's more, the amendment is much, the constitutional amendment and the idea of the charter is much more related to the functions, how we would operate, the powers we would have to carry out those matters which the legislature has determined should be or could be carried out by a metropolitan service district. And I don't think it would go to expanding the definition of what a matter of metropolitan concern was unless the legislature had agreed to it.
Thank you.
Okay, when you go for a charter, you have functions that you're allowed to do and those that you're currently involved in. Your charter would have to spell out what you could be involved in, not necessarily just what you are involved in or what you would hope to get involved in.
It could do that. The question of how the charter would be drafted if this resolution would be approved and approved by the voters would be, is the resolution simply empowers the legislature, directs them to provide by law a method by where the electors may adopt a charter. The whole question of whether this would be, how the charter would be drafted initially and what version of a charter would be placed on the ballot would be something a subsequent legislature would have to provide a methodology for. And at that time, people would be making choices between a very explicit charter, such as the city of Portland's, which is almost this thick and has, I think, over 100 enumerated powers, which are very, very narrow and specific, which are their total powers, or something which the city of Idana has and some other smaller cities, which is merely a page or two long, which provides for fairly general, broad powers for them to carry out any functions or duties that a city may have. And the choice of what specificity went into that charter would have to be made at a subsequent time.
Okay, are there any other questions? John.
Question was raised at an earlier hearing as to what extent the language in the existing resolution would provide you with taxation authority. And I'm just wondering what your thoughts were on the extent to which you saw the language providing the authority to tax.
Unless restricted by the legislature, I believe a charter could provide for the district to have authority to levy what taxes would be necessary to carry out the functions and duties provided for by law consistent with the Oregon Constitution. Any real property taxes would obviously have to be subject to the constitutional provisions that you'd have either a tax base or a serial levy for the specific real property taxes. If there were any legislative provisions such as there are, which presently restrict counties from taxing utilities using county road right of way, then they would obviously control as well. But as a general rule, you would have, as a county has or as a city has with a home rule charter, the authority to adopt taxation measures, whether fees for services or excise taxes or modified income taxes. Multnomah County has a tax on rental cars, taxes of any nature like that that are otherwise permitted by law for home rule entities, then Metro would have that power too, if its charter specifically provided it. The charter could have restrictions written into it that would limit that taxation authority, or it could have broad powers granted to the council to adopt ordinances imposing taxes.
Mr. Chair, as you indicated, it would also be restricted by anything the state had passed that says they couldn't do something.
That is correct. Any, I think legislature has the power to decide that as a matter of statewide concern, certain areas shouldn't be taxed. There are numerous statutes that do that and restrict cities and counties right now from taxing either certain functions or types of businesses or certain activities, and you would still have that authority.
Okay, is there any other questions? Okay, what is your pleasure on the amendments?
Are we in work session, Mr. Chair?
Yes, we're in work session.
Mr. Chair, I would move the amendments -A2, but changing it so that the phrase as prescribed by law on line 3 is removed, and then there would be a period and a quote right after concern.
Okay, it's been moved to accept the 2-A2 amendments with the period after concern on line 3 and deleting as prescribed by law. Is there any objection to that? Seeing none, those are adopted. The City of Portland wanted to make some comment on this before we move beyond this.
Is that the person on the floor, I guess, there?
And Multnomah County, I guess.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Marge Kefouri with the City of Portland. I think I'm a gavel fall late.
No, that's okay. I didn't realize you had signed up, and so we can do anything then. You have four votes to do.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The dash two amendments before this committee discussed with them, I picked up this morning and read to our city attorney, and he was a little confused about what he thought was some ambiguity in the language and suggested an alternative, which I've passed out to you, which, if we're understanding what Metro is trying to achieve, he believes accomplishes the same purpose with a little bit more clarity. At least that was what his recommendation was. And what he would suggest to the committee for consideration would be in line 15 of the A engrossed SJR2 to simply amend it to say a district charter may provide for the exercise by ordinance of those powers over matters of metropolitan significance granted to the district by the Constitution or laws of the state, rather than the language in the dash two. So I offer that for the committee's consideration.
Mr. Chair, of course, that's the nub of the issue, because it's a difference saying that you can do what the law says you can do, and it could do that now without the voters having anything to say about it. Well, it depends on how it's listed in the law. There are two or three different, that is, powers have been given to Metro at different times in the statute. As I recall, the first list they could do without any reference to anybody else, but there was enough other features related to them that made it practical or not. They've not really gotten into the area-wide aspects of sewers, for example. Another set of powers were subsequently given to them, which requires, that I think, voter approval to do them. Amending this section 3, as you proposed, it really doesn't give them any more powers than they currently have. You don't need a charter to do that. It would simply say you can do those things the law permits you to do. You can do that now. You don't need a charter to authorize that.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Hostetler.
Is the City of Portland and Multnomah County still interested in these amendments after we've adopted the dash two, or is there any reason why you're going to urge these upon us at this time?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hossett.
Just late date.
My Board of Commissioners is concerned with this SJR 2, even as amended by the Senate, that it not potentially put into the Oregon Constitution language that would override county home rule authority. And I believe that's the concern shared by the City of Portland. And we have concerns with the language you just adopted in a new sub 4 to say under the Oregon Constitution that a metropolitan service district shall have jurisdiction over matters of metropolitan concern, and leaving it that and not allowing the legislature or the Constitution otherwise to define what are matters of metropolitan concern. A phrase that does not exist statutorily now, the phrase is matters of metropolitan significance. We are concerned about that, and I guess would have, although I haven't run the specific language by my board, would believe that they'd be somewhat concerned about the language you just adopted, and would ask you to adopt the language proposed by the City of Portland and Multnomah County in lieu of the language.
Mr. Chairman, can I ask?
Go ahead and follow up.
Why don't you just try and defeat the bill then? I mean, it seems to me that the effect of your amendment is to essentially say that the charter is meaningless because it still would require the legislature or the Constitution to delineate the powers of Metro, and that the voters within the Metropolitan Service District wouldn't be able to do that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hostica, the Metropolitan Charter, if this constitutional amendment were adopted, and then a charter proposed to the voters within the Metropolitan Service District were adopted, would only be as meaningless as is the Multnomah County Charter or the Washington County Charter, in as much as they only have authority over matters of county concern as to the structure or form of governance of those governments, and not substantive police powers, if you will, over subject areas.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes,
I guess I don't know this. We're venturing into matters, I think, that might require longer discussion, but it seems to me that a charter that says that you have jurisdiction over matters of county concern then allows the voters within the county by a majority to determine what is a matter of county concern, and then if somebody wanted to, through some other avenue, dispute that, a court could determine whether it was a matter of county concern or not, but it wouldn't require the legislature to make that determination. Your amendments, it seems to me, which the word those is a limiting and not an encompassing statement, would say that, that it would only be the Constitution or the legislature which could define what a matter of county concern was. And I think that is different then from what a home rule charter for a county provides for the county.
Mr. Chair, I think it's important to recognize only the voters of a governmental unit, local government, can abrogate home rule powers generally. But the courts and the legislature operate on the understanding that you can take a function or part of a function away from a governmental entity and not take away its home rule powers. In other words, when the legislature provided for the Enabling Act for Metro and allowed the voters to establish it by vote, it gave it certain regional aspects of functions initially, and one of those was, area-wide sewer, solid waste, as Metro was created immediately, had an area-wide aspect of solid waste. But there was no argument made that in giving Metro that regional aspect of solid waste, it was abrogating the home rule charters of those cities or counties. But indeed, it did take, or could take, away a function or part of a function from an existing unit. The concern clearly here is that if you give the voters of Metro the authority by charter to go to the polls and say, we want Metro to have the regional aspects of police, for example. If you, in fact, had a charter as it is stated here, or as proposed by the amendment, the voters, in fact, could do that. If you use the amendment as proposed by the city and the county, it could do no more than it's already permitted by law to do. Keith.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cease, the language you've just adopted doesn't even say that the charter shall prescribe what jurisdiction the district would have over. It says by constitutional language that you, the legislature, couldn't, in fact, modify that the district shall have jurisdiction over matters of metropolitan concern. You've deleted the language as prescribed by law, so you've taken away any legislative authority to modify that constitutional language. I suspect my board would be satisfied if you at least guaranteed that the charter prescribe district jurisdiction over matters of metropolitan concern. We're not anti-metro by any means, and would be supportive of a charter adoption that would allow the district itself and the voters within the district or within the metropolitan area to determine how many councilors it has, whether it has an appointed or an elected executive, et cetera, issues that ought not to concern the Legislative Assembly and should concern those of us who live within the region. If, in fact, the voters were able to vote for charter provisions, such as Representative Cease advocates, apparently, then I think we would certainly be happy with that. But what concerns us is constitutional language that's this broad. As broad as what you've just adopted.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, then Representative
Stein. I guess we're in the Constitutional Convention for Metro here, so we might as well look at ourselves in that light. But if we start under subsection 2, it says the officer shall exercise all the powers and perform all the duties as granted to impose upon or distributed among the officers by the Constitution, laws of the state, by the district charter, or by its authority. I think by implication, that's where Representative Cease is indicating that if the voters of the district by charter adoption or by charter amendment provide for authority over a matter of metropolitan concern, as we just now amended it, then they would be able to do that, and they wouldn't have to rely upon the legislature to delineate what powers and duties they had. And I think, at least in my mind, that's the essence of this whole thing. And if all we're saying is that the people by charter can determine how many councilors they have and whether the executive is a member of the council or not a member of the council, I'd say it's probably not even worth going through the exercise. And so if that's your intention, I would suggest you ought to try to defeat the bill rather than further amend it. Because if you do amend it, I'm voting against it. You have it.
Representative.
Yeah, I wonder if this would help on the amendment. Instead of as prescribed by law on line 3, if we said that Metropolitan Service District shall have jurisdiction over matters of metropolitan concern as set forth in the charter of the district. I think that's what we're trying to get to, where the... And I don't know if that answers your concern. I don't know if that...
Yeah. It doesn't bother me.
Yeah, it seems like that would clarify the concern the city has, but still keep the decision about what can this MSD, what the Metro can do out of the legislature, which is what we want to do with it.
Mr. Chairman.
How does that sound to the Metro? Okay. Yeah. What I was going to say is that as a practical matter, I think if this passes on the state level, and then a popular vote and change the Constitution, and then you get to making a home rule charter, you're going to have to tell us how you're going to collect your taxes. And you're going to have to tell us what kind of activities you're going to be in. And I'm saying us as voters in the metro area, or nobody's going to buy it. So I think the charter itself is going to be fairly tight just by necessity. But I think this wording is good. Did everyone get that? Mm-hmm. After concerns, you drop the period and put a comma, and then as set forth in the charter of the district.
By the charter of the district.
Set forth.
By the charter of the district.
That's the definitive. So we've been in law school, say in.
What do
we got?
And set forth in the charter of the district.
So it's fun writing the Constitution in pencil.
Okay, the motion by Representative Stein is to amend the amendment that we've already adopted and put after concern insert set forth in the charter of the district.
As set forth.
As set forth.
Mr. Speaker, I understand that at the point then you put the charter out, put it to the ballot, you would have clearly indicated in the charter what they could do, but that would mean the voters could not subsequently add a function to the body. That's what that means, isn't it?
They could join the charter. The charter could prescribe how it would be amended.
All right, that's
Is there any objection to that amendment? If not, so approved. And so what we have before us is the bill and an amendment that changes what we'd adopted earlier and says concern is set forth in the charter of the district. Yes, Representative
Ready Costa. For a motion,
yes.
Then? I move to ask JR2 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Okay, Representative Hostica moves SJR2 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Edward?
Representative Cease?
Aye.
Representative Hostica?
Aye.
Representative Oakley?
Aye.
Representative Stein?
Aye.
Representative Markham?
Aye.
Representative Young?
Aye. Passes. What's next?
Okay. Mr. Chair, I wonder if we could take that statutory part that relates to that and look at that. The one we talked about, the statutory section.
And
function.
Okay, well, I thought we were going to put
that in this other bill, yes.
Yeah.
Yes, okay.
Okay. The next bill, Mr. Chairman, would be Senate Bill 212, or excuse me, Senate Bill 258.
Why don't you take that for a minute, Bill?
Okay. It'd be Senate Bill 258. This is a bill that amends the existing statute to increase the size of the Metro Council from 12 to 13. And to clarify that the councilors be elected on a staggered basis, approximately one half every 2 years.
And that's the basic intent of the bill. I understand that Representative Cease has a possible amendment to propose to the bill relating to governing structure.
Yes, I do, Mr. Chair. Let me see if I think it's in the other folder.
Isn't it? It's in the SGR 2 folder.
It's in 3990.
3990.
Here.
Oh, there it is. Got that. This has to do with the suggestion Mr. Chair made earlier that we indicate, put together a bill that would allow Metro by statute to change its form or structure. As it turns out, even if we hadn't adopted the charter, or had adopted the charter, we could not attach these together since one is a memorial and one is a bill. But what this would do would be to say that Metro, they could do that as soon as this became law, and if the charter never goes into effect, they would have the authority under statute to change their form. And as they could increase or reduce the number of councilors, they could have an elected executive instead of a 21, and so forth. The thing that is missing from this proposal, however, as it is printed, it would allow the electors by ordinance to prescribe the organization of the district government. It would also allow the council to do that, but what is missing, I think, would be a needed statement that if the council initiated it, it would have to go to the voters for approval, so that no change in the structure could be accomplished without the approval of the voters.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hoskin.
Yeah, when I was reading this, it seemed to me that that was your intent, Representative C. So I'm wondering if just by striking out the words the council or in each instance, and you just said the electors of the district may by ordinance prescribe, whether that would meet your concern, because the only way the electors would have a proposal before them was either by initiative or referendum.
Well, the only thing I would want to make sure is that the council could initiate it,
right,
but would then be required to put it on the ballot. And any language that would do that, in any case, if the voters do it or the council does it, the voters themselves would finally have to approve it. But it would allow the local people to change their structure without coming back to the legislature. I think that's the key.
Who's signed up on
it? Who's signed up
on it? Go ahead, gentlemen.
Just two things very quickly. One of the things that we'd ask the staff to note is there will be some conflict amendments necessary. You've passed, and the governor has signed the reapportionment